There are a lot of wild places, and many of them are truly spectacular. I just came back 3 days ago from the country of Nepal, where I've worked for many years, where we've been very successful in recovering some of the most charismatic species on Earth, like tigers and rhinoceros.
Why has it been easy in Nepal to recover from some of that loss?
That's a great question. People often say that in the world today, where we have so many charismatic species that live in very poor countries, that in these countries, they really won't have conservation until they have economic development at the level of some of the more wealthy countries. And yet, in three of the places that I work, Nepal, Bhutan, which is next door to Nepal, and the country of Namibia, they're three of the poorest countries on Earth. Yet, if you actually look at their success in conservation, of conserving tigers in Bhutan, or snow leopards, tigers, and rhinos in Nepal, or lions and elephants in Namibia, they're more successful than practically any other country on Earth. So this idea that there has to be economic wealth first before you can do conservation, I think, is a myth. Many of these countries realize that you really can't develop unless you conserve your natural resources first, because it's from that basis that development is actually possible. On top of that, the Nepalese are an incredibly innovative people and willing to try new ideas. And it's the first place that we ever captured and radio-collared tigers and rhinoceros. Some of their policies are the most progressive on Earth for conservation. Back in the middle 1990s, Nepal was the first country in Asia to decide that 50% of all the revenues generated by their national parks would go back to the local communities that live around them. And that instantly made very poor people conservationists overnight.
What a wonderful program.
I don't know why that isn't adopted in more places. You see that in some individual parks, but there are very few countries that have taken that on. And the forests are better managed by the people than they are by the national forest system. So much so that the wildlife has returned in these communities, and they've created their own community-based ecotourism programs. One that we set up about 23 years ago, there used to be fishermen who fished out all the fish in the river and then would sell it in the market and to get some cash for their families to buy rice. And so we said, how about instead we pay you not to fish, and instead you become the boatman for boat rides down the river that you fish on? Well, we did that, and within 2 years we had a very healthy crocodile population on this river, and fantastic bird life, all kinds of kingfishers and storks. And now the community has this boat ride run by these former fishermen. And the two communities together, between their boat rides, the elephant rides they take in their forest to show people rhinos and other wildlife, foot safaris, they earn $1,000 a day. So $365,000 in a year for very poor communities is unbelievable.
Yeah.
And it's changed their economies.
It's a windfall.
It really is. And it shows how conservation can be the basis, can be the engine for economic growth around national parks. It's an idea that we have to get out there more and more.
What about Namibia? How does it work there?
Namibia is probably the greatest conservation success story in the world that nobody knows about. I describe Namibia as, if you think of the wildlife of East Africa meets the scenery of southern Utah. So you have these spectacular escarpments and mesas and beautiful red rock deserts, but you have elephants and rhinos and lions, but they're desert elephants and desert rhinos and desert lions. They're adapted to these drier conditions. So back around 1990, they were still under the influence of South Africa, and it was an apartheid system. When they had independence, they decided to give ownership of the wildlife to the local people. And that meant that they could use it for their own benefit, but also hopefully help conserve it. WWF started a program there, creating what we call communal conservancies, where the ethnic groups there could form into an organization that managed the wildlife for the benefit of the whole community. And it started out first in some places with trophy hunting, because there are wealthy Americans and Europeans who want to go and shoot animals for their trophies, and they make a lot of money from that. But very soon it became much more economical, and beneficial to develop ecotourism programs. And so Namibia chose a very high-end ecotourism program where they have these very expensive lodges that are shared with joint ownership with a community and a major company. And the people in those communities staff the entire lodge for everything from the kitchen help to the guards to the trackers to the managers. And the revenues go back to those communities. So it has changed conservation in Namibia such that probably in a country the size of California and Oregon and Washington put together, in a few years, more than 50% of the country will be either under these conservancies or national parks. And again, a very, very, very poor country has managed to use its wildlife to be the engine for economic development.
Do you see that as a scenario for high-income countries such as the United States?
I think so. And in fact, we're trying to apply some of the lessons that we've learned in Namibia here in the United States. For example, World Wildlife Fund has, I think, one of the most iconic projects in the United States in central Montana, where we're trying to recreate a giant bison preserve that will be twice the size of Yellowstone. And we're on our way to doing that. It's in an area around the Missouri Breaks, the upper Missouri River. And a big piece of that is the Charles M. Russell Wildlife Refuge with several Native American reservations. And we're bringing back genetically pure bison to this area. Some of the ways that we're trying to use the techniques in Namibia are these community-based ecotourism lodges. We're also looking at that in Nebraska and South Dakota. This area in Montana that we're working, the populations are declining. The average age of the ranchers is around 65. Without subsidies, it would be very hard for a lot of those families to continue to ranch or to farm. And I think most of the more enlightened political leaders out there realize there has to be another stream of economic development besides relying on the traditional ranching, timbering, mining. And conservation could be that fourth pillar. And we know that that's certainly true in Yellowstone. For example, back at the turn of the century, before Yellowstone was a park, there were 2 million sheep grazing across what is now Yellowstone. And I think if you polled, and they have, most people who live around there, would you like Yellowstone to go back to a giant sheep ranch? And the answer is absolutely not, because the local communities are making so much from tourism. So we hope to repeat that someday people will have a chance to go to the Great American Prairie Reserve in central Montana, and that hopefully World Wildlife Fund have played a catalytic role in trying to make that happen. So I think we can learn these lessons.
I'm glad you're optimistic.
You have to be. You know, I don't think you can be in my line of work and not be. How you look at the world is colored by where you've been, and I've been fortunate, or maybe perhaps I've chosen where I go to work, where the places that I see conservation at large scale is really possible. I suppose if I went to some other countries where most of the wildlife has been extirpated and the attitudes towards conservation aren't very progressive, I'd have a more pessimistic view. But in all the travels that I've made around the world, I've never heard anybody say to me once, you know, I'd like to live next to a degraded environment. A deep love of nature, it's genetically embedded in us. And how we tap into that, and then how we provide the economic incentives, because that's really what it is. And that's much of what our work at World Wildlife Fund is about, is how do we come up with the economic incentives to want people to live next to wildlife, to want to make tigers be worth more alive than dead, or rhinos or mountain gorillas. That's our big challenge of the next 20 years, because I believe if we can just hold on for this next two decades, that there will be enough of a groundswell of support for conservation in most of the countries that we work in. And these places where we've had some very successful examples of conservation that can be applied to other countries in the world.
You wrote a really interesting short article in the Huffington Post in January, mm-hmm. I believe it was, about spirituality and how that is tied to the desire for conservation. Mm-hmm. You've just made a really interesting tie in of how the spirituality of it is now inextricably tied to economics for a lot of people.
I think that people see, they talk about the conservation crisis and how we're losing wildlife. I mean, you know, not to be too Pollyannish about this, but for example, last year, 688 rhinos were poached in the country of South Africa. That's horrific, considering how much progress we made. But I think the key point here is that the conservation crisis is really a spiritual crisis in disguise. And that's what I wrote about in the Huffington Post, is that, you know, so many people love their pets. For me, the spiritual evolution or the cultural evolution of our species will, one marker will be when we take that love of our individual animals, our pets, and apply that to species with the same fervor. So that's what I hope for, that in 10 or 20, 30 years, we'll see that more and more, is that people feel that same affinity for wanting to keep their pets alive, to have the same cognizance and care and concern for wildlife as well. I think we'll get there.
On the little bio on the World Wildlife Fund page for you, it says, you've also led an unprecedented effort to identify every ecoregion on the planet and define the most biologically important species. Mm-hmm. How do you define what's most biologically important?
If you were not a biologist working for World Wildlife Fund, but you were a geologist, say, working for an oil company, you wouldn't drill randomly. You'd use all the information that is at your fingertips from seismology, geology, because you know that oil is concentrated in certain places. And so that's the places that you'd drill. Biodiversity is the same way. Because of a whole bunch of features, the isolation of continents, the uplift of mountains, climate, nature is concentrated in certain places and not so much in others. And it's our job as biologists, kind of like prospectors, to know all the information at our fingertips to map those out. Because if biodiversity is concentrated, then we get a lot more bang for our buck by focusing on those places where it is concentrated than spreading our money out, trying to conserve it everywhere. We have to set priorities just because of some of the points that you mentioned about the threats that we face and how timely they are. So this effort was to pick those places where nature is concentrated in terrestrial systems, freshwater, and marine. And from that, we created this map called the Global 200, which are the 200 most important places on Earth where nature is truly concentrated. And if we save those, we would probably save 95% of all species on Earth.